Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. We've synchronized our watches. I think we've got 1:30. It is my pleasure to introduce Sharon Baranowski, who is a master's prepared advanced practice nurse of 31 years of experience in nursing management and wound care. She is a well-known lecturer, consultant, author, and educator on various nursing and wound care issues. She's co-editor of the textbook, Wound Care Essentials, Practice Principles. She has authored numerous book chapters and written over 100 nursing articles. Wow. She is a fellow in the American Academy of Nursing, has served as president of the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel, and has actively participated in numerous AHRQ and CMS projects as an advisor. She's a peer reviewer for Advances in Skin and Wound Care and Nursing 2010. She's currently on the board of directors for the American Professional Wound Care Association and is an active member of the Wound Ostomy and Continence Nurses Society. Please join me in welcoming Sharon Baranowski.
Well, welcome back right after lunch. I know that's always a hard time to come back, and then you have to sit for an hour and a half lecture, so we're going to try and keep you entertained and keep you awake. But if you shut your eyes for a little, I absolutely understand. Thank you for selecting this. You have a lot of options out there to choose from in today's session. Actually, all week long, it's an excellent conference and giving you a lot of opportunities to pick different things that are in your area of specialization. And I really appreciate you coming to this one because it is an up-and-coming problem that we're going to start seeing more and more attention given to. And today's lecture is on SCALE, and that stands for Skin Changes at Life's End. We're going to be talking for the next session time allotted here about the importance of what the 10 SCALE consensus statements are. We'll get a little bit more detailed about that in a minute. Be looking at skin changes at life's end and talking about recognizing some of the options with skin failure and what we as nurse practitioners can be sharing with our families, our patients, and certainly our peers as well as other healthcare professionals. As I said, SCALE is an acronym that was thought out with a great deal of effort. A couple of years ago when the consensus committee eventually got together. And skin changes at life's end, and it was specifically written that way with the focus being on life's end and not just end of life, but the life's end, what we can do to look at skin integrity, what we're accountable for, because, you know, it's such a litigious society that we live in that we're seeing more and more legal actions taken against facilities, against nurses, physicians, and such and so forth on a lot of skin issues. Wound care is one of the fastest growing areas of legal concern. I could retire and not do anything but review cases. That's how many are out there. I'm constantly saying no, can't do anymore, constantly giving them out to other nurse practitioners looking for people to do case reviews. That's sad to say, but that's how many cases that are out there. So I'm really glad that you're here today so it helps provide you with some information about a consensus document that has just come out. In fact, it was just published in Advances in Skin and Wound Care, the May 2010 issue that just came out. So you can get the full document with all of the statements in that in this particular issue. When we're talking about SCALE and the consensus document, we are not talking about a risk assessment. Risk assessment is something, when we're talking about skin and wound care, is something that we need to do, but it is not what the actual document involves. And it was written to apply to all healthcare settings, so that when you're looking again with skin and issues and the dying process, it doesn't make any difference if you're in home care or if you're in acute care or if you're in hospice care. It's still a concern and an issue. All of this started to evolve back in early 2008, literally about 2 years ago now, when so many of us were seeing the growth of lawsuits in this area. We are also seeing the issues and the concerns with pressure ulcers that are developing in end-stage diseases, and seeing the changes that can occur in skin integrity, and looking at, wow, a whole lot of healthcare professionals are at risk here. We're all taking the blame for a lot of pressure ulcers that are developing, and that's a concern for institutions across the board, but yet there's nothing we could have done to prevent these. And so it's looking at providing some documentation, and hopefully all of this will stimulate all of you who are taking care of patients to start thinking more about skin integrity, but also looking at statements that we're going to present and see if in your patient population, maybe you should start taking and collecting some data to see what your own patients are doing. We really need more research, and we need more data out there. And even if it's a retrospective review that you're doing of your patients to get it written, to get it published, because there's not a lot out there, as you will see when we're talking about skin integrity and the dyeing process. The panel was composed of physicians, nurse practitioners, nurses, attorneys, physical therapists across the country who worked a great deal at developing the statement and then did a Delphi process to have it reviewed and looked at internationally then getting people to sign on to read it, approve it, edit it, and work with developing this statement so that it could be a universal document. One of the very first things that we had to decide on is what the heck is end of life? How are we defining end of life? And so the panel decided to use the American College of Physicians statements from Kwasim and Snow that define end of life as a phase of life when a person is living with an illness that will often worsen and eventually cause death. During the end stages of life, any number of vital systems can be compromised, and skin happens to be one of those that we're going to talk about, to varying degrees and will eventually totally cease functioning. So that was the definition that we built this consensus on. The consensus panel looked at that the skin, which is the largest organ of the body, is really no different than other organs, and that also can become dysfunctional with varying degrees of resultant compromise. So just as other organs can diminish their function, so can the skin in a dying process. We have to stop and think about our skin and what is our skin, and essentially it really is a window that is into the health of our body. Looking at our skin can tell us a great deal about what's going on. So if we read it correctly, this can provide insight into what's happening within the body and what we can then start to look at and think about. Some of the compromise that we're going to be talking about is changes that are related to skin compromise. And because your body is shutting down, and because there's lack of tissue oxygenation and circulation and such and so forth, you also have decreased cutaneous skin perfusion, and you have localized hypoxia. And when that occurs, it's affecting the tissue as well as the cellular and the molecular level. So it's not just a cutaneous concern. It's affecting everything underneath the skin as well. When we have all this compromise, then it's pretty difficult to try to sustain normal skin integrity when you have the decreased availability of oxygen, when you have poor utilization of vital nutrients. If the patient isn't getting vital nutrients, then they certainly aren't getting dispersed throughout the body. And if you have poor tissue perfusion and oxygenation, they're not getting dispersed anyway. So when all of this occurs, it starts to alter the body's function, and that includes skin. Skin compromise is really not a new issue. It's been around since 1877. When Dr. Jean Martin Charcot described in the very first medical textbook, the very first known mention that we have of skin compromises back in 1877. And yes, this is Dr. Charcot, that the Charcot foot in diabetics is named after. And he first noted that his patients were having ulcers and that they were somewhat in an odd shape and that they were butterfly in shape and that they mostly occurred on the sacrum and the coccyx area. And that shortly thereafter, when he saw these particular ulcers, this is when patients died, 2 to 4 weeks after. So he started to document this. And then he came up with the term decubitus omnius, meaning death of the skin. Well, 112 years later, that's how long it took for us to get anything in the medical literature again about skin compromise. And guess who did it? A nurse practitioner. Karen Lou Kennedy is a family nurse practitioner that originally was out of Indiana. She now has moved to a warmer state named Arizona. But Karen first discovered, she worked in the long-term care setting, and she was noticing a lot of skin integrity problems with her patient population. So she is the very first one as a nurse who actually wrote and published anything in this, what we call modern medical literature, that actually looked at a subgroup of pressure ulcers. And that these patients were dying after they developed these pressure ulcers. And so she termed the name of these ulcers the Kennedy terminal ulcer. Have a lot of you heard of that term or not? No? Anybody? Okay, only a couple of you. It's been out there, like I said, since 1989, and unless you worked aggressively in the wound and skin area, you probably haven't heard that term, which is unfortunate. But it's starting to evolve a little bit more now. And this is what some of them, oh good, you can see them pretty good. They're really light on my screen, so I wanted to make sure you guys could see these, because this is kind of what the whole heart of this whole issue is that this is what Karen Kennedy took pictures of and some of her original patients that were involved in her study. And she did a 5-year retrospective study looking back on the patients in the long-term care setting to see how many of them developed pressure ulcers and what was the length of life after they developed these unusual looking wounds, and came up with like 56% of them died within 6 weeks. And she thought, boy, that is really unusual. So she started really logging the data. And what she discovered when she started logging it, and she was just doing what I'm saying all of us could really do to help expand this initiative. She started logging what are the shapes of different ulcers that she was seeing in certain high-pressure areas. And she realized that some of them are shaped like a pear. Some of them are shaped like a butterfly. This is supposed to be the pear. Now, I don't know. I'm not really an artist, but it doesn't look too much like a pear, but that's a pear. Some of them are shaped like a butterfly, if you can kind of see here and down here. Butterfly, this could also be a horseshoe, it's often referred to. And this one, the patient's laying on their side, so it's kind of like this way. So they've got a wound here, here, and here. So it's kind of going red all around here. So this is the area that was most at risk. It doesn't mean you can't get them in the heels and other areas, but these were the areas that were at the highest risk. And that these wounds presented as red, yellow, black, but they had a sudden onset. So she was documenting that you could put the patient up in the Jerry chair for breakfast, leave them up in the morning, they have lunch, you put them back to bed after lunch, and these ulcers were there. So it was like within 4 to 6 hours, these ulcers were developing. So that was, again, what was extremely puzzling. And they deteriorated then extremely rapidly. So once you see it, it goes downhill really quick. And that she was wondering, does this indicate that death is in fact imminent very shortly? After her work then, two other nursing colleagues, see, aren't nurses great? They're the ones that had the interest in it in the early years. So Hansen and her colleagues, which is a large nursing group out of the Dakotas, they supported all the observation that the Kennedy terminal ulcer had. They did, again, another huge analysis, and in their patient population, 62% of the pressure of people who developed pressure ulcers in their hospice patients occurred 2 weeks prior to death. So their study showed even a less time frame than Karen Kennedy's did. Hers was 6 weeks. Then two doctors decided to get involved, Dr. Parrish and Dr. Witkowski, and they're both very well-known wound care researchers and physicians, and they got involved. And then Dr. Langamo and Greg Brown are, again, two nurse practitioners that, again, continue to get involved in the 93s and 2006. And, again, they supported that the mechanism of pressure ulcer occurrence at the end of life may not be preventable in patients with multi-organ failure. So this is some of the very first work that we're really seeing from Langebo and Brown that are actually talking about patients that are developing a pressure ulcer or a Kennedy terminal ulcer or a deep tissue injury, that these particular types of wounds may not be prevented. Up until now, we haven't had anything in the literature that says we can, in fact, prevent these. So, therefore, nursing and institutions were all taking the hit on not providing standards of care, and therein being why so many lawsuits can then evolve. So it was very encouraging to finally see something written that said, hey, maybe this isn't preventable. A common but frequently unrecorded occurrence is what we're seeing with end-of-life changes. What we see is documentation of the pressure ulcer or the wound on the leg or wherever it may be, but we're not seeing it anything associated with end of life. So again, this is where there's a lack of information in the literature, and we're not picking up these changes as being related to a potentially imminent death that's coming within, you know, 6 weeks or give or take a few weeks. Pressure ulcers and the new accountability, I'm assuming that most of you all know that the rules of the road have changed when it comes to pressure ulcers. They've been around forever. We're doing prevalence on them in many institutions across the country, and we do this prevalence and data collection, and it's part of benchmarking that facilities use to show that they are, in fact, improving their healing rate of pressure ulcers or their prevention rates. We do know that most pressure ulcers are preventable. Most, not all. And that's this very strong statement that we want to, you know, to share with you and get out and support with other nurses that aren't here today. And that skin changes, including pressure ulcers, that occur at life's end may, in fact, not be preventable. The new penalties that are out there for acute care is that hospital-acquired conditions are present on admission. Ulcers are some of the new documentation that's out there. So that if you develop a pressure ulcer in an acute care setting, you will no longer get the additional reimbursement that you used to get. You'll still get reimbursed for the patient's care. You'll still get your DRG amount. But you won't get the additional where before you could add on DRGs and comorbidity conditions, and you could get more money if your patient had a stage 3 or stage 4 pressure ulcer. Now, if they acquire it in the hospital setting, there is no more money to get. So the hospitals will be penalized now for pressure ulcers developing. Well, that's tough if you've got an oncology unit, or you've got an in-hospital hospice unit, or you've got a rehab unit, or you've got intensive care units where patients often do die. And so where does that put us with this hospital-acquired condition? So it's looking at, wow, this can have a lot of ramifications down the road. Long-term care settings have still developed what's called the FTAG 314, and that is specifically addressing pressure ulcers. The new long-term care MDS tool is scheduled to come out October 1st of this year. And I say that with tongue in cheek because it was supposed to come out a year ago. So hopefully it's out this year. And it addresses, again, pressure ulcers. And they have finally improved the documentation in long-term care so that it's matching what the other disciplines are doing. And so reverse staging of pressure ulcers is finally thrown out the window. Home care has jumped on the bandwagon, and they've always had in their OASIS documentation tool for home care, they've always had some questions about wounds and skin and pressure ulcers. Well, they have expanded that now with the new OASIS B tool that came out in January of this year. So everyone has realized that these are a major concern and that we need to do more to protect ourselves and certainly our institutions, but also looking at what we need to educate the patient and the family on. So with all of that in mind and that background, that's how the actual consensus panel got together and said, what can we do? What do we need out there? How do we let people know? We have a lot of stakeholders in this game of skin and wound care. What can we do? So we done mammoth lit reviews trying to find out what's out there and coming up and then sharing it with people so that you too can be responsible for your own data collection and start monitoring it, and hopefully down the road maybe we can see you write some of those articles. Let's take a look at the 10 consensus statements and some discussion regarding them. Physiological changes that occur as a result of the dying process, and that can be days or that can be weeks, may affect the skin and soft tissue and may manifest as observable changes in skin color, turgor, or integrity, or as subjective symptoms such as localized pain. We do now know that when we're talking about skin and wounds, that if a patient has an area of tenderness or actually has a wound already, and they haven't been complaining of pain a lot, and then all of a sudden they start complaining about pain, that we need to aggressively start looking at that wound a little bit more and potentially doing some culturing, because the new wound and pain standards are that there could potentially be an infection in that wound, and that is triggering an increase in the pain. So with statement number one, some of the comments are that these changes can be unavoidable. That skin changes, as you see up here, may occur even with the application and the best practice, and you're doing all of the appropriate interventions. You've got the patient on a bed. You're supporting the turning and repositioning schedule. You're getting the patient off of the wound. You're getting them up, if possible, to ambulate them. You're applying an appropriate moisture barrier product, or you're applying an appropriate dressing to help with prevention and or treatment. And you're doing all of this, and you're exceeding what's considered the minimal standard of care, and the patient still develops this. So at that point in time, if you have in fact done all of this, are you in fact then liable for this still happening? And so the issue is looking, what can we do, and do we have enough knowledge base out there for that people understand what tissue perfusion really is and how it impacts wounds that develop like this? When we're looking at statement two, the plan of care and the patient's response should be clearly documented and reflected in the entire medical record. And I underlined clearly documented because that's an area that we're not seeing. And you as a nurse practitioner probably do good documentation. I'm assuming you all do. But you work with other people, and sometimes you're coming in to take care of the patient when a nursing staff has taken care of the patient, and now you're coming in as a consult. Or maybe you're coming in as the wound care person. So your documentation is always held at a higher level of care because you are an advanced practice nurse. However, the standard for nurses who work in home care, nursing homes, long-term care, rehab, what have you, is that there is still good documentation, and the rule does still apply if it's not documented and it's not done. Unfortunately, I'm sure a lawyer wrote that somewhere because it's not in any of the healthcare textbooks, so I'm not sure where that all came from. But over the course of time, it's something that we're all forced to live with now. Unless we have enough other evidence to support that we did everything that we could, it's hard to stand up and defend yourself that we did everything and the pressure ulcer still occurred, the Kennedy Turman ulcer still occurred. Charting by exception is an appropriate method of documentation. It is. How many of you do charting by exception? A few of you? This light is blinding, so it's hard to see. Put your hands up again. Okay. So the rest of you do narrative? You have grids and charts and check sheets, and then you write whatever you need to? Okay. All right, because what we're finding with charting by exception is an accepted method to document, and pretty much across the country is becoming more and more popular. The problem with it is everyone's not doing it appropriately. And so if you're charting by exception, it means that you're not documenting anything unless you see an abnormality. Unless there's an abnormal finding, you're really not seeing anything to do with you're not seeing anything documented on the charts. So where do you see that your education has been documented? Where do you see that you have informed the family that they can expect to have some skin care problems? You're not seeing that. And what we're seeing is extremely poor documentation when it comes to skin. We see skin is, what is skin? Warm, dry, maybe intact sometimes. That's kind of about it. Skin is warm, dry, intact, maybe a little red, maybe a little cold, maybe a little hot, warm, depending. But that's kind of it. We're not really seeing, you know, a more involved skin assessment done. So charting by exception is okay, but you have to make sure that where you're charting by exception at, that there are some facility policies that say what you're supposed to do and that people are actually doing it. Your statement three, patient-centered concerns should be addressed, including pain and activities of daily living. This term, patient-centered care, is kind of a buzzword right now. Have you all heard that, patient-centered care? It's kind of out and about. We see it in a lot of the articles that are coming out. And about a month ago, I was in Iowa, and I was lecturing to an audience that was 80% physicians and 20% nurses. And so I was talking about patient-centered care, and I kind of just stopped and decided, you know, I'm going to throw out to the audience, how do you define patient-centered care? What does that mean? Well, it was quite interesting, the replies I got back. And it made me realize that we throw out a term like patient-centered care, and we really may, in our own mind's eye, have different definitions for it. And so some of the docs felt patient-centered care meant you talk to your patient. Some of the nurses said, well, that means that you share your information that you have from taking care of that patient, and you make sure you share it with who's following you on the shift. Is that okay? One of the doctors said, well, I think it's got something to do with family, too. I think you're supposed to involve the family. And so the term really had a lot of different meanings. And I said, well, it's all of those, but it's really focused on what does the patient want. It's focused on, are you meeting the needs of that patient? Are you doing what the patient needs? Are you providing interventions for that particular patient? And that patient is in agreement. And or his family, if he is not cognitively able to tell you what they want. And so they were all like, oh, yeah, well, we kind of know that now. And so, you know, but looking at terms like patient-centered care, and it should be addressed, including pain and activities of daily living, is not something that we all maybe fully understand. So you need to make sure that who you're talking to understands what you're talking about. When we're looking at wound care, these wound patients are very much impacted by pain. Remember, we're in a dying process here. So they want to be pain-free. They don't want to be laying there and be miserable and suffering from wound pain. So they're impacted by pain. They're impacted by a change in body image. And it's not that they care so much what they look like while they're dying, but they don't want to be embarrassed by their families. And they don't want to not be embarrassed by their families, but be embarrassed because of their disease process. And then their families are upset. They don't want to be up walking in the hall with them and the dressing falls off. They don't want to have odor. Odor is so, so, so important in this population. They don't want people coming to visiting them and the room is filled with an odor, as many wounds can certainly have. And they certainly want to be up as much as their body can tolerate, and depending on what stage they're at. So it's looking at involving all of this in your plan of care. And part of your being patient-centered is taking in the whole physiological as well as the sociological and the emotional impacts of what dying and skin have in common, and that we need to look at. It's part of that whole process. Statement four, skin changes at end of life are a reflection of a compromised skin system. It's where you have reduced soft tissue perfusion. So there's not enough blood supply, not enough circulation going on. There's decreased tolerance to external insult. And this is very important because those external insults are often being utilized in the end stages, such as oxygen still may be on. We're seeing an increase of wounds on the ears, a lot of increase of wounds on the ears, a lot of increase on wounds on the back of the occiput. A lot of them, where those were pretty rare before. So the ability of the skin to tolerate what it once could has changed. And because we have a impaired removal of metabolic waste, again, this alters the whole utilization of appropriate nutrients as well. And even in spite, then, of what you do, and if you look again, here's another ulcer that looks pretty much, well, you could start the top of the horseshoe. Again, this patient developed one because this little lady here, she's always in bed, always with her heels on the bed, refuses to elevate her legs because she has arterial compromise. Also, besides dying in end-stage renal failure, she also has arterial compromise, so elevating her legs causes her more pain. So she wants her legs flat, which she has a right to request. But then she's developing wounds, and then the family is upset because she's developing the wounds and thinks you're not providing good nursing care. Expectations around the patient's end-of-life goal and concerns should be communicated among the members of the interprofessional team and the patient's circle of care. So in other words, everybody who's taking care of the patient, whether you be a healthcare professional or whether you be the aunt, the uncle, or the neighbor who's ever taking care of this particular patient, we need to be sure that we're communicating much better than what we currently do. And part of that communication is talking about skin function. I have a lawsuit that I'm working on right now, and as I was reading the deposition of the daughter of a patient who was and is suing because her mother developed a tremendous pressure ulcer, and she felt that the nursing staff let her down, that they let her mother's skin rot, that's what she called it, and that she had no expectation that this could even possibly occur. And she says in her depo, the doctor let me know that my mom's cardiac function was going to start to decrease and I could expect irregular heartbeats. He also told me that my mom is not going to have much of an appetite anymore, and so she's not going to eat a lot, so don't keep forcing her to eat. And he told me that she's not going to be as thirsty as she used to be, so if she refuses sips of water when I give them, not to get upset. But nobody told me that my mom's skin was going to fall off. And so it's that whole concept of we educate sometimes for what we consider the vital organs, obviously, the heart, lungs, kidneys, etc. But we kind of forgot that when all of those are compromised, you cannot maintain skin function. And we're not educating patients and families that this is a potential risk factor. You can expect that your loved one may, in fact, develop some skin integrity problems. You may see abrasions and frictions from us moving them or them scooting themselves. You may see skin tears occur. You may see pressure ulcers and obviously bed sores if you're talking to them, and let them know what that is, and let them know that that may not be a reality, maybe it won't happen, but it is an expectation that it could occur, because that's where we see the system failing, is that we're not getting enough documentation out there, so therefore the legal system we set up, tremendously so. And the case I just talked with you about with the daughter, they ended up settling out of court because they didn't have enough documentation to support that she was wrong. There was absolutely no documentation that anybody in a huge institution ever talked to her about compromised skin or the risk factors. So while we may, in fact, conduct a skin assessment or conduct a Braden risk assessment and implement the interventions, we're doing the tasks, but we're not educating the family as to what those mean. And that's the biggest problem that we have right now with why you're going to be held very accountable for some of these. This is just another schematic to show that as healthcare professionals that are caring for patients, we need to have wound care expertise. If it's not our forte, then we need to consult with who is. That we should be functioning with an interprofessional team. So it's more than just the doctor and the nurse. It's the physical therapist. It's the dietitian. It's the social worker. What do we need? And in the middle of all this, it's still the patient and the family and the caregivers. And so it's like the knowledge that we have needs to be transferred. And we transfer it to practice, but we're not transferring it back to the patients and the families and the caregivers. Statement 6 looks at risk factors. What are some of the risk factors associated with scale? Well, that picture of that lady sitting there is my mom. And she died a few years ago. And she's the one who said, "Sharon, take a picture of my arm. You can use it in one of your lectures someday." It's kind of hard to see, this far away. But if you look at her hand that you can see all the bruising and the discoloration, that's on her arm. And she was dying. This was a few weeks before she passed away. And she was a typical case for this, in that she had the weakness. And she had the progressive limitations. And she couldn't get up and ambulate anymore. And she was really confined to bed or to chair. She wasn't eating, so she very much had suboptimal nutrition. She had absolutely no appetite. She was losing weight. She was down to 85 pounds when she died, very cachexic. Her albumin level, serum albumin level, hemoglobin, hematocrit, all of them, everything indication of dehydration was very obvious. But that was her wish. So when she developed a pressure ulcer on her sacral area, the nursing staff were very upset. And when I came in to see her, they were thought I was really going to be upset, seeing that skin and wound care is what I've done my advanced practice in for 30 years, is looking at issues just like my mother was having. And I said, no, I absolutely understand. Do you understand? And I was explaining to them why her skin was becoming insulted, because they said, we don't know what we did wrong. Because we've got her on a specialty bed. We've been turning her. Honest, we've been turning her. We get her up all the time. We're using a moisture barrier. We never let her stay wet. You know, we've been doing all of that. So, you know, we don't know what we could have done. And I said, nothing. There's nothing more you could have done. Do you all understand? She is in the dying process. And all of her organs are slowing down. And they said, well, yeah, we know that. And I said, but do you understand that if her kidneys are slowing down, her urinary output's slowing down, she's in constant atrial fib, she's not doing well, why do you think that her skin would not be affected? And the nurse looked at me and she said, well, that makes sense. But it's like it just went right over here, so we're not tying it together. As part of, again, statement six, what really is the number one reason that we have skin integrity problem is really what's stated right here, and that's that the diminished tissue perfusion, impaired skin oxygenation, decreased local skin temperature, mottled discoloration, and skin necrosis. And just as you see at this picture on the bottom, with the bottom of the foot becoming mottled, it's not because the patient has an arterial problem. It's because the body was shutting down as part of the dying process. And this person was developing that mottled foot shortly before death. This is typically what you're going to see a lot of, and you typically see it in the feet, the fingers, the ears, and ironically, even the nose. Not a whole lot of cartilage there. So those are big areas that we really need to monitor and just, you know, be observational with. Loss of skin integrity from numerous factors, equipment, and devices. Like I said, the oxygen tubing is huge. And I don't know that if it's when, because of all the poor tissue perfusion that we have in oxygenation, that these oxygen tubings get pulled really tight. So we're seeing the nasal septum breaking down, and we're seeing a lot on the ear. And in another case that I have, it's unbelievable to me that we see pictures of a patient who was discharged from acute care, and in the ambulance ride, literally in the ambulance ride to the nursing home, lost part of their ear. So the nursing home's saying, well, it happened in the hospital. The hospital's saying, well, when we discharged him, the ear was there. Well, it may have been there, but the insult already occurred. And so then the dead tissue fell off, and guess what was there? So, I mean, those things, unfortunately, as sad as they are, do happen. We need to look more at incontinence. Again, it's not something that you're going to cure when we're dealing with life's end, but it's something that we need to look at maintaining whatever best practice care that we can, and trying to limit the exposure to any type of fluids, any toxic chemicals. The skin cannot handle it. There's not enough perfusion there to fight off or be resistant to anything else. And especially if you're dealing with patients that have, on top of the death and dying process, they have an immune compromised disease, then that limits their ability and they break down even faster. When we're looking at skin assessments, should be performed regularly and documented in all areas of concern consistent with the wishes and conditions of the patient. Well, a couple of terms we need to talk about here, and that is skin assessment regularly. Make sure where you're practicing that you, as well as where you're practicing, understands what that term means. Does their policy say what regularly is? Because the majority of policies that I see out there say that a skin assessment is going to be done every 24 hours. And that means it must be done every 24 hours. And when it's not done, again, it's you are negligent in following your policies and procedures. So that's a big issue. What is a total skin assessment? There's nothing in the literature that defines what a total skin assessment is. I have in my book, I wrote in the skin chapter, what I consider to be a comprehensive skin assessment, but that's about it. So most of the time, like I said, its skin is warm and dry, color intact, and that's it. But what we're talking about is more involved, looking at what's going on with the whole patient and looking at all of these particular areas and paying special attention to bony prominences and devices and issue tuberosities where you're all sitting on right now and the back of the head. It's looking at them, and it's actually documenting that all bony prominences, you know, are intact or they're not intact. But then it's also looking at describing what you see. This particular wound that you see has numerous ways to look at it and numerous ways that someone can document it. The nurses documented it as a stage 2 pressure ulcer. The doctor documented it as a stage 1 pressure ulcer. The wound care nurse came in and documented it as a deep tissue injury. This is all in the same patient. In a matter of 2 days, we have 3 different diagnoses from 3 different sources. And that's what complicates the care of these patients if we don't know what we're dealing with. And when we're looking at end-of-life stages, what kind of care do we need to be doing? We need to be providing comfort. We need to be looking at what are the expectations for healing, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. But we need to look at describing what you see. You need to have a knowledge of what staging of pressure ulcers are. If you're not good at staging pressure ulcers, there's tons of resources out there. I'm sure there's resources in your exhibit hall that you have here or books. You need to get really good at it because it's such a hot button now with CMS, and insurance companies follow CMS, as you're very well aware of. So you need to be really comfortable that you know what you're looking at when you're staging wounds. And you need to be sure that if you're documenting something that you see as contradictory to the physician, then you need to talk with that physician so that you can get on the same page. Because, again, we need an accurate diagnosis. We don't see these terms being documented. Maybe you guys are because you're nurse practitioners. But, again, if you're working with others, we need to be using these terms when we're doing that total skin assessment. So it's not just skin warm and dry. We need to know if there's lesions out there. We need to know if there's any erosions, if they're seeing skin tears. Those are things that total assessment really, really needs to have in it. So we've given you a little chart with some of the key ones that you probably can see. And when you use the term lesion, I see documented a whole lot the patient has a lesion, on their right hip. What does that really mean? I don't know if it's a pressure ulcer. I don't know if it's an abrasion, an erosion, a bruise. I don't know what it is. So, again, the term lesion really is defined somewhat, and it's best to use some of this type of terminology where you're saying the patient has a flat or an elevated or it's a blister and what the size is. And if you don't remember maculopapular patches or whatever, at least a measurement. Just, you know, a quick little measurement of what the lesion is, and then that can kind of give you a clue. Or to help educate nurses as well. Regular nurses have forgotten this. We've all learned it in school, but we really didn't retain it unless it's our specialty. Statement 8, consultation with a qualified healthcare professional is recommended for any skin changes associated with increased pain, signs of infection, skin breakdown, when the goal may be healing. So you're going to call in all the big guns if the goal is healing. You're going to call in the wound care nurse or the wound care physician or the wound care physical therapist. It differs across the country. You're going to call in all these people if the goal is to heal this wound. And whenever the patient's circle of care expresses a significant concern. So possibly your goal, possibly the patient's goal, is not that this wound's going to heal because the patient and you are probably a little bit more realistic, and you know, well, the wound isn't really going to heal. But that family doesn't understand that again. So if it's their expectation that you should be calling in more consultation, then it's, again, our responsibility to explain to them why we are or why we are not. And we don't see that a whole lot. So when you see patients that are presenting with this particular type of wound, and you see the dark area, and you have everybody calling this a stage one pressure ulcer because the skin is intact, but if you assessed this area a little bit more, and if you palpated it, and you feel how mushy and boggy this dark area is, you will know that you have more tissue trauma down next to that bone, and so that this is not just a stage one, that this is an expectation that this is going to open up. So that if the family sees this and then they come the next day and this is open, then that's what triggers them to say, we don't know what we're doing. We're doing poor care, or we're doing no care, or we were negligent, even worse if they decide to, you know, to do legally something. So again, it's the education of that family that's really important, as well as the patient. We need to know in our consultations that we've got, like I had just said, an accurate diagnosis. So you can't have everybody calling something what it's not. You need to all kind of come together. And you need to look at how is that related to the skin in the dying process. We need to identify a diagnosis so that we can have the appropriate interventions. And those interventions really, truly need to be based on whether a wound is healable, whether you're maintaining that wound, or whether it's non-healable. It turns into a palliative type environment, and we do not expect that wound to get better. And I've provided you with the definitions of what the consensus panel came up with these particular terminology and their definitions. And that is, healable is the underlying cause, can be corrected. Body can support the phases of wound healing. So this may be in someone who is not in end-stage disease process, end-stage dying process. This may be someone who has developed a stage 1 or a stage 2 pressure ulcers, and now we're going to get them up, and now we're going to ambulate it, and now we expect it to heal. When you're looking at maintenance means that you do an attempt to keep the wound from deteriorating. So we're providing appropriate wound care, moist wound therapy dressings, debridement if necessary, irrigations to keep the wound clean, silver dressings, antibiotic therapies, all of that to maintain the wound at the level that it's at so that it doesn't get any worse. The wound may also not heal due to the patient's choice. The patient may say, I've had it, I'm done, no more treatments. You know, or the lack of resources that are available to that patient. So those are considered what we call a maintenance wound. The wounds that we're interested in scale all really are non-healable wounds. It is not an expectation that these are ever going to heal. Sometimes they do in spite of what we do and kind of fool us if the patient gets an upsurge of a vascular supply. But with non-healable wounds, you have inadequate systemic and local factors to support the phases of healing. So there's nothing there that's going to stimulate the wound healing process, the inflammatory, the proliferative, the maturation. All of that is not going to happen because the body just doesn't have the energy to do it. They just don't have enough vasculature left that's really going to put a healthy blood supply into this wound to heal it. Because everything has already been shunted away from the skin to help keep the patient alive. So everything going to the heart and the lungs and the kidneys to keep the patient alive. So not worrying about getting these wounds to heal. And so these are the wounds where, you know, they're just going to exist and we cannot correct the cause of them. And you're going to see toes like this then develop. And you're going to see the patient end up with gangrene of the toes. And that's inevitable. And that is very, very scary to family members. Oftentimes the patient doesn't even know it because they can't see their feet and they're not looking, but families do. And so it's very, very hard to understand why this is happening. So when you're looking at non-healable wounds, normally best practice tells us to do these three things. They're telling us, you know, if you've got a wound, we're going to do some type of local wound care. And that means we're going to be looking at debriding a wound, cleaning it up, either surgically, enzymatically, with maggot therapy, with different types of dressings. We're going to try and get that wound and get that non-viable tissue out of that wound so it can heal. We're going to look at bacterial burden, and we're going to look at what we can do to reduce it, to keep the wound and the wound infection out. And then we're going to look at making sure that we're providing what is considered best practice, and that's moist wound therapy dressings. All of that relates to healable wounds, not non-healable wounds. So in a wound that does not have the ability to heal, moisture balance and active debridement are contraindicated. It's best to let the wound dry out. It's best to let it have a black scab on it. It's best to let it just shrink up and dry out. It will never heal, but it will become hard and indurated. And unless the family and the patient change their mind and want it debrided or cleaned up, then that would be the only reason that you would do that. But it's best to leave it be. We do not need to spend a lot of money on high-tech dressings as if we are attempting to heal this wound. So to cover this wound with a lot of calcium alginates or oasis dressings, or to do applograft and skin substitutes and all of that, would be totally inappropriate. It's totally not cost-effective for the family. And they're, even if they have insurance or no insurance, it's not cost-effective. And it's not going to help the wound to heal anyway. You cannot heal a wound with the best magic medicine in the world unless you can heal the blood supply and the oxygenation. So this is where the big problem is, and that we see a lot of people still trying to meet the standard of care because they've set their standard of care to be based on healable wounds. So if you're the one that's writing those policies, you need to make a clarification. If you deal with a patient population that you have non-healable wounds, if you're seeing the patients in hospice, in the end-stage dying process of long-term care or rehab or wherever you may be, you need to have a distinction between a healable wound and a non-healable wound. So that you may, in fact, if the patient has a concern, and you have a concern with bacterial reduction, then topical antimicrobials can still be used, and they're relatively economical. If you put a silver dressing on something, it's going to help maintain killing some of the bugs that are in the wound. It may not get rid of all of them, but it may be enough to maintain and control the odor. Or you may want to look at using antiseptics, which we have told you all along is totally against best practice for wound care. So when you get into end stages, then you go, whoa, I'm still doing best practice, but that doesn't fit the case now. So what do you and what can you use if you are, in fact, dealing with unhealable wounds? Well, you need to look at, these are some of the products that are still out there, and the most popular being betadine and povidone iodine. You know, that's still a very appropriate one. And it still has a broad-spectrum antibiotic. Yes, it's toxic to healthy cells. We're not dealing with healthy cells, remember. Yes, acetic acid is out there, and that's okay, too, because acetic acid is very, very much effective against Pseudomonas and the odor that Pseudomonas can have. And so it's okay to use it. Before, we're telling you, stay away from all these because it totally destroys fibroblasts and macrophages, and all of the essential cells that we need to get these wounds to heal are being destroyed by the antiseptics. Well, right now we don't care because it's not healable. Right now we want to keep the patient clean, odor-free, pain-free. You know, and at least in a state of where they're comfortable, if their families are visiting them, that the wound does not smell, And if you talk to enough wound care patients, that even to their dying breath, they do not want to have an odor. None of us want to have an odor. That's why we use deodorants and perfumes, because none of us want to have an odor. And either does your patients, and just because they're in a hospital and just because they're dying, that doesn't change. So keeping them odor-free with the use of some of these antiseptics is the only option that you may have. Statement 9, the probable skin changes, etiology, and goals of care should be determined. Consider the SOAPY mnemonic and the 5 P's for determining appropriate interventions and strategies. And so when you're dealing with a patient such as the one that you see, the 5 P's are on the screen. So we're looking at, you know, what's your plan of care for prevention? Prevention for further insult. Not, again, prevention to prevent a wound from happening. It may have already happened, but you can prevent it from happening as best that you can. But if it does happen, where are we going to help? Trying to keep it from deteriorating, if we can. What are the interventions that we should be doing? What preservation, improvement, obviously, is going to be extremely limited, as I said. Your goal should be comfort and care. And first and foremost, what does your patient want? What are the patient's wishes? A lot of patients don't want to be bothered. My mother did not want to be bothered. We had covered her because it was a stage 2, and I thought, well, we're going to keep it from getting any worse if we can, realizing that that might not be a reality. But she didn't like, we were using a hydrocolloid dressing on her. And she did not like that dressing on her. She said, this is uncomfortable to lay on. Because remember, she had down to 85 pounds, very bony. And so that was interesting to me, because I look at that dressing and I think, yeah, it shouldn't be that uncomfortable. But when you have no muscle tissue left and you're emaciated and you're, anything on your bone is obviously very uncomfortable. So you're looking at, you know, she found it to be very uncomfortable and it would wrinkle up if she scooted or moved. And she hated the fact that it caused her tremendous pain when it was removed. And when you think, well, they roll off and they really shouldn't be causing pain. But remember that you're dealing with a compromised skin integrity. So the ability, and pain is one of the things that's stimulated. So your nerve endings are still there. So when people were pulling this dressing off, that caused her a lot of discomfort. So therefore, she refused to have any dressings on at all. So then I come again, and she's got no dressings on. And I finally said, so be it. You know, I knew I was fighting a losing battle. I take after my mother, so I do know I was fighting a losing battle. But I also knew that there really was not a whole lot of sense to it. It was causing her that much problems. So those are some of the things you have to kind of think about and look at. And this is the SOAPY mnemonic that the consensus document is talking about. And it's just a simple walking through SOAP and the IE down at the bottom where you're looking at, you know, what are the subjective skin and wound assessments? What are your objective observations? Just kind of the same things that we were kind of taught before. Assess and document, you know, the etiology of wound. What's your plan of care? Make sure that it, in fact, is patient-centered. Consider all of your 5 P's when you're looking at implementation and evaluating, you know, what's going on. And being sure that you're looking at educating your stakeholders. So it's again, a mnemonic that just helps people to kind of trigger and think. Some people like tools. And statement 10 is looking at patients and centered patients and concerned individuals should be educated regarding scale and the plan of care. And this is a big problem because, as I've said all along, I keep telling you we got to document it, and the essence is we're not. So the whole focus of this entire document is to look at what we, as providers of health care, what we can do to make skin care at life's end better and make it recognized that everything that we're doing may not, in fact, mean a darn thing except patient comfort. It may not be that we're not healing these wounds, but understanding that when I look at policies and procedures in institutions, and I'm sure some of them are yours because I'm from this area as well, and I know some of you are from all over, we always got one of those goals is that the patient will not develop, you know, any skin integrity problems while they're here. You know, the goal is to heal the wound. That may not be, again, for everybody. So you set yourself up for problems. And to realize that pressure ulcers happen, they are not totally all preventable. The National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel now has on its website, their website is www.npuap.org. If you go on their website, they have a position paper on avoidable versus unavoidable pressure ulcers. So we're starting now, everybody's starting to, like, you know, let the world know that we cannot prevent all pressure ulcers. Even though our founder, Florence Nightingale, in her writings say that nurses are responsible and nurses are negligent if a patient develops a bed sore. So for that one issue, I don't know that we want to thank Florence, even though it is National Nurses Month. But that's what everybody thought. And so nurses are the ones that have potentially always been blamed for the development of pressure ulcers, when in fact it's the patient's body and internal systems. So the overall entire goal of this paper is for healthcare professionals to look at, one, figuring out how you're going to better communicate, and two, collaborate across settings and disciplines. When you're transferring patients from one setting to the other, they need to know what's going on with skin. They need to know what's going on with any kind of wound. And that needs to be part of your transfer across the continuum. And we're not seeing enough of that. That may change in the future because CMS is evaluating, it's in its third year, a document that's called the CARE Tool. And the CARE Tool is being piloted across the United States in different states and in different healthcare settings, all of them. They're trying the tool out in every setting. And it's trying to come up with a tool that will look the same for all settings to use so that you can actually, the tool will go with the patient. That's not such a bad idea. Right now, it's way too big. It's like 40 pages. So, you know, that's a problem. So there are people from across the country evaluating and working with it. And their goal is that the pilot is done in 2011. And their goal is that 2 years after the pilot's completed, that they will be able to present to us a uniform tool that all healthcare settings could use. So that's kind of, I hope, not pie in the sky. You know, hopefully that does actually evolve. I think it will kind of help us along the way. But it's also looking at your organization. If you're employed by a hospital or nursing home or a home care agency, does your agency support the fact that scale can exist? Do you have the policies in place that you need for your practice or for your facility's practice that say not all wounds are healable? And at life's end, that even is twice as true. So I guess in summary, I would say to you that the integration of palliative care concepts needs to meet wound care concepts. We've got the whole best practice of wound care out here, and we've got palliative over here. And we haven't pulled them together. We haven't said it's okay not to do moist wound therapy dressings. We haven't said that, so we've got people doing a lot of crazy stuff. So we need to look at integrating this whole concept into the wound management concept, and so that it's okay that we're providing care that is appropriate. We need to be looking at viewing palliative care as a natural evolution of treatment options so that the options are going to change as the patient's condition changes. And once we get to life's end, that the treatment changes are going along with it. It would be amazing to you, or maybe not, if you've worked in wound care and you do some wound care stuff, at the dollars and cents we spend in the last week on negative pressure therapy, rotation beds, calling in physical therapy consults, calling in, you know, the certified wound care nurse to try a new treatment. I mean, and we know that the patient does not have much time left, and the dollars and cents spent at that is astronomical. And it's not benefiting the patient. How much more better to spend time with the patient and holding their hands and talking about them and giving them pain control and keeping them odor-free and making sure they're comfortable versus making sure their dressing got changed and a hydrocolloid got put in or an alginate or whatever. It's more appropriate, again, to focus on what is going on with the patient. Again, that's truly what patient-centered care is. And then certainly last but not least is taking the stigma of blame away when a patient develops a pressure ulcer or a Kennedy ulcer or a skin tear when you're at life's end. All of this is an expectation as long as you let people know that it's an expectation. As long as you let the patient and the family know that these are things that could potentially occur. And that we're going to try to prevent them, but unfortunately, they still may, in fact, occur. If you go to this particular website, which is Gamar Industries, and they are the company that provided an educational grant for the development of the consensus statements on skin integrity. Very nice of them to do this because they are a bed company. And their whole intention was they were just seeing so many patients at end of life and skin inappropriately treated. So they pulled together and developed an educational grant. So if you go on their website, you can see the whole thing. If you're interested in knowing the ins and the outs of how this tool was developed, it's got a whole bibliography, and they're actually our little cheat sheets are what we call enablers that you can use in your practice, as well as there's a whole PowerPoint presentation there that you can download if you want to do a presentation for your staff. If you want to do a presentation for your institution, then they give you a whole presentation to take and run with it so that you can educate other people that scale, that skin change at life's end is something that we cannot always avoid. It's something that we cannot always prevent, even with the best of nursing care. And we've got a few minutes left. I left for some questions. Anybody? And Polly, you can turn the lights back on if you want. And is there any questions about skin? Yes. Okay, and your question is, do I get called in to do that, or do you? Okay. Okay. Her question is, if you as a nurse practitioner get called into another facility, like a long-term care or a hospital or what have you, and you come in, the patient's already got the wound, and they want you to be the end-all and the be-all and evaluate it and diagnose it and figure out what to do? To help them determine it wasn't their fault. Okay. You know, that's a tough call because you weren't there in the beginning, so you don't know. What you can only do at that point in time is kind of pull together a little focus group of the people who took care of that patient and looking at the chart and saying to them, all right, let's walk through this chart. What did we do? and you look at prevention, and you look at appropriate interventions for best practice. Then you got to go and put your nurse practitioner hat on, and you need to start assessing the patient, and you need to look at everything that's going on, and their nutritional level, and their labs, and their lack of albumin and prealbumin and H&H and all of that. And then you say, you know what, you did the expectation. You met the minimal standard of practice. Remember, and that's what we have to meet, the minimal standards of practice. You don't have to exceed it. But you met that minimal standards of practice. That's all you can really do, and if you weren't there in the beginning. But I think you can give them a safe answer. If you assess the patient from a chart perspective, and physically, if the patient's still with us, and say, okay, now this is what we need to do now. And then the best thing is, did they document that they did any of this stuff? Did they document that they talked to the family and the wife and the kids and the caregivers or whoever? Because chances are, you're not going to see it. And so, as much as we've all can stand in our head and spit in our shoe, I can't get documentation to be better. Even with computers. I was so optimistic computers were going to be better. But what I'm seeing with computers is they're actually fragmenting a whole lot of the care. I'm seeing that we aren't having good wound assessments developed because everybody's, purchasing different types of programs. And some of them are very, very good. And then some of them are pretty skimpy. And they leave no room to write a narrative. So you can't, exaggerate on about what you're seeing and what you talked about because there's no place to put it. So, any other questions? Okay, I'll just start over here and we'll go this way. Oh, the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel. National Pressure Advisory Panel. It's nicknamed NPUAP. And it's .org. And if you go on there, you can get copies of wounds to use in a presentation. You can get copies of the staging system. There's several different white papers. What's new on there that really just came out is mucosal pressure ulcers. Yeah, you go like that. That's what we all kind of did. Because there seems to be in the intensive care settings an increase in mucosal pressure ulcers. Again, intubation devices and nasal nares, the tubing, and we're seeing more. And so now the issue is, how do you stage those? You don't. You call them mucosal pressure ulcers, but you don't put a stage on them.
It's in line with standardized
for measuring? Measuring, yes. Actually, the standards do exist. I shouldn't say standards. I correct myself. The guidelines, okay, difference. Okay, the guideline is recommending that you measure greatest length and widest width perpendicular, and that's what. And then depth. All right. So what you're looking at a wound, you're not just doing 12 to 6 o'clock on a clock would still be your greatest length. It might be more like 11 o'clock to 7 o'clock. Maybe that's the greatest width, but it's up and down. Your widest width, then, is the widest width of the wound, not 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock like we used to do. We used to measure wounds just like this. Now you measure them perpendicular, so wherever the widest area is. That is the recommendation. A lot of people still aren't doing that yet, but that is the recommendation. Okay. Okay, I think you're next on the end. Good point. Excellent point. Right. I did say, you know, that pain is a new indication of a wound being infected. And yes, at end of life, do you need to do cultures? No. But I was giving that perspective so that you know that that's one of the new signs and symptoms of infection is pain now. So on a patient that's not at end of life and all of a sudden you get pain in a wound, you might think, whoa, what's going on underneath? Maybe I better look at a culture. But no, at end of life, I absolutely agree with you. Increase your pain medications. Okay, the lady in red. Does the pediatric population have skin changes? Yes, they do. Yes, they will. And what you'll see probably first with the pediatric population is because of their body size, you're going to see dehydration. You're going to see really dry skin or real frail, thin skin developing. But yes, they do go through this as well, not as aggressively. But what we see with the little ones is the occiput. That's usually, you know, where the majority of their body weight is, so their occiput breaks down. And it's a misnomer to use donuts, even in a peds unit or a neonatal unit. You know, those donut things that people blow up or the foam ones. Those don't disperse pressure. So if you're using those, get rid of them. All they do is disperse the pressure off the center of the wound and send it right to where the donut is. And so when they put these little kids on those little round donuts, they think they're really helping and they're just intensifying the pressure around where the wound is, and that's what you need to help the wound to stabilize.